intrigued, and she wrote back. And the upshot was she invited me to New York. I was living in Philadelphia, and she said, if you can get up here, I will introduce you to my editor, and you bring your manuscript, and we'll see what he thinks. Well, it took me a while to talk Ward Cleaver into letting this happen, and he finally caved when I told him that I had found an all-women's hotel and that I would stay in the all-women's hotel. And he said, well, then that makes it okay, but you have to promise me you'll stay at the women's hotel. So I did. And I went up there. I met Vin Packer, who turned out to be a remarkable woman, still writing. Her real name is Mary Jane Meeker. She's written as Anne Aldrich and M.E. Kerr and various other names. Absolutely brilliant and very interesting. And she took me over to the Gold Medal Books offices near Times Square and introduced me to Dick Carroll, who was the editor-in-chief. An old movie guy. He'd written film scripts. He'd been a film editor. And they brought him into Gold Medal to see if he could handle the new original paperback section. So he read the book as a courtesy to Mary Jane in just a couple of days. And I went in to meet him with my knees knocking. And he said very kindly, you know, this is not a good book, but he saw something in it. And what he saw were the two sorority girls of my story, Beth and Laura, whom I had carefully shunted off to a shadowy corner. And he said, bring those girls center stage. They are your story. And go home, rewrite the book. It should be half the length it is now. And tell the story of the two girls. Which rocked me, because I thought I had been so subtle that nobody would pick up on the fact that the girls were romantically interested in each other. So I went home, I cut the length of the book in half, I told the story of Beth and Laura, and brought it back with some terribly proper title like Same Time, Same Place, which had nothing to do with anything. And within a week, I heard back from Dick Carroll. He said, we love it. We're going to publish it. The title of the book is now Odd Girl Out.
And my secret love's no secret anymore.
Steve Pride continues his conversation with celebrated lesbian pulp paperback writer Ann Bannon.
So who is Beba Brinker?
Bebo was my fantasy butch, and I kind of dreamed her up based in part on a sorority sister who had the look, but not the emotional engagement.
Next time on This Way Out. Thanks for tuning into This Way Out, the international gay and lesbian radio magazine. This week, Donna Ann Ward, Christopher Gall, Rex Walkner with Bill Kelly, Sherry Lunn, and Steve Pride contributed program material. Thanks also to Eric Beauchemin and Radio Netherlands reporter Vera Sujan. Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out is underwritten in part by a grant from the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation and through donations from our listeners. Thank you. Log on to thiswayout.org to see how you can support our work, hear our podcasts, or subscribe to CDs of our programs. To receive our weekly program email alerts, email tworadio@aol.com. You can also write to us at Post Office Box 38327, Los Angeles, California, 90038, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappell and the entire This Way Out family, I'm Greg Gordon. We all thank you for listening on WREK Atlanta, Georgia, Switch 1197 AM Brisbane, Queensland, Boise Community Radio, Boise, Idaho, and more than 175 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Do stay tuned.
You can hear This Way Out every Monday evening between 7:30 and 8 p.m. here on WPKN in Bridgeport, 89.5 FM, and WPKM in Montauk, New York at 88.7 FM. My name is Scott Harris. I invite you to stay tuned next for Counterpoint. And just a quick preview of what we got coming up. We'll be speaking with attorney Michael Ratner of the Center for Constitutional Rights. And we're going to be taking a critical look at President Obama's recent release of the Bush administration memos authorizing torture. And his, more importantly, the decision not to prosecute CIA interrogators who administered torture to U.S. held detainees. Independent journalist and author Dar Jamal will be joining us, and he'll be talking about his recent trip back to Iraq. We found a dangerous breakdown in the fragile truce between former Sunni insurgents placed on the U.S. payroll there and a resumption of anti-occupation resistance. We'll also be speaking with Mark Weisbrot, co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, who's going to be looking at the results of this last Latin American summit meeting in Trinidad and Tobago, where there seemed to be some early signs of a possible thaw in U.S. relations between Cuba and also Venezuela. So we'll be hearing more about that. And lastly, tonight we're going to be bringing you some of the conference that took place in New York City called The Left Forum. And we'll be hearing some discussion about the left and the relationship with the Barack Obama presidency. So that's one thing that we're going to be doing at the close of the program tonight, some audio highlights from The Left Forum in New York City. So stay tuned. We've got Counterpoint coming up next.
An earthquake, birds and snakes, an airplane. Lenny Bruce is not afraid. I have a hurricane, listen to yourself. Turn world, serve its own needs. Dummy, serve your own needs. Beat it up and not speak. Grunt, no strength, none matter. Start to clatter with fear, fight down. High choir in a fire, representing seven games in the government for hire in a combat site. Let the weapon come in a hurry with the fury screaming down your neck. Keep my team reformers, Babble Trump, Kevin Kraft. Look at that. Four towers, slice and burn, return. Listen to yourself, turn. Locking in, uniform and book, burning blood, letting every motive escalate. Automotive, centering. Light a candle, light a motive, step down, step down. Watch a heel crush, crush, uh-oh. This means no fear, cavalier, renegade, steer clear. Turn them in, turn them in, turn them in, fly. Offer me solutions, offer me alternatives, and I decline. It's the end of the
Good evening and welcome to Counterpoint. My name is Scott Harris, here Monday evenings between 8 and 10 p.m. Thanks so much for joining us on this night. In a moment, we'll be speaking with Michael Ratner about the Obama administration's recent actions regarding Bush-era torture. We'll also hear, as I mentioned a moment ago, from Dar Jamal talking about his recent trip to Iraq and the situation there, which is quickly seeing a spike in violence. Mark Weisbrot will be talking about the recent Latin American summit meeting in Trinidad and Tobago, and some highlights also tonight at the end of the program from the Left Forum, which took place in New York City this past weekend. But first of all, I want to welcome a friend of the program and a friend to human rights across the world, Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights, which represents many of the U.S.-held detainees at the Guantanamo Detention Center in Cuba. Michael, thanks so much for being here tonight.
Great to be with you again, Scott.
Yeah, the reason, of course, we wanted to speak to you tonight was some very important developments in the focus of your work, which is getting to the bottom of U.S. torture policy and human rights abuses that we saw under the last Bush administration. Importantly, we had a couple of mixed signals here. The Obama administration did release the memos authorizing torture from the Bush legal advisors. And we also had the decision by Obama and his Attorney General Eric Holder, which said that CIAs would not be investigated or prosecuted. There are a lot of open questions there, but maybe I'd ask you first of all to speak to the importance of these memos. What did we learn new from the release of these torture memos?
Well, you know, some of the outlines of what was in these memos was well known. The legal arguments justifying torture under, you know, very bad legal reasoning. The arguments that you needed sort of basically, I mean, that you needed organ failure to amount to torture. Those kind of arguments we've seen before. What was important about this memo were, I guess, a couple of them. One that came out, which we hadn't seen, which applied the specific torture techniques to one particular detainee, Abu Zubaydah, and it went through in detail the kinds of techniques that could be used against Abu Zubaydah, with all kinds of, like, all kinds of really gobbledygook, I mean, just junk language to try and justify that you could actually torture Abu Zubaydah, and included such things, which we'd seen some of in the Red Cross reports, but to see it laid down by an official of the U.S. government, in this case, Bybee, who is now a current sitting federal judge in the Ninth Circuit, to see Bybee's memo, which was also probably written by you as well, which tells how to torture Abu Zubaydah, how many minutes water can be poured in his mouth, how long he can be be put into a small box, how insect can be introduced, but it can't be told that it could sting him to death, because that somehow would go beyond what that would actually clearly violate, and then there's no way around it, the prohibition on torture. But it all did, the whole set of it. And then in a couple of other memos which were released that took place in 2005, which were by Stephen Bradbury, and that was new, because we thought when Stephen Bradbury took over the Office of Legal Counsel from Bybee, and really you essentially, that he had maybe reformed the office a little bit. But when you read those memos, he didn't at all. And those memos indicate some amazing facts, that Abu Zubaydah was waterboarded, or suffocation by water, as the Red Cross calls it, 83 times, and that colleague Sheikh Mohammed, 183 times. So that the idea that this was set forth in memos, it's the most chilling reading you can imagine, really some of the worst documents I think to ever come out in the U.S. democracy that I've ever seen. And that's why I think, Scott, you were right when you said, well, we're getting sort of a mixed message. The positive part of this, if you can say that, is that Obama was willing to release these four memos. Of course, we want him to release much more. We want him not to take the state secrets defense in all of our lawsuits and the ACLU's lawsuits, which this administration, the Obama administration, has been doing. But it is a pretty big step. And as we can talk about, he did go to the CIA to try and discuss that step on Monday of this week.
Now, Michael, what about the decision from Obama and Eric Holder that the CIA operatives who actually subjected these detainees to abuse and torture, that they would not be prosecuted, they wouldn't be investigated? Does that not speak to a different set of standards than the U.S. used during the Nuremberg trials in Nazi Germany, that
yes.
I was just following orders defense seems to be upheld here?
Yeah, I mean, there's two groups of defendants, or maybe three we can talk about. One is the operatives who actually carried out the torture and the waterboarding. Second is the legal memo writers, you know, the U Bybees of the world. And the third are the principals from Bush, Cheney, Rumsfeld, Tenet, etc. And of course, I think it's important for your listeners to know that George Tenet and Porter Goss were both at the CIA when this was going on, and Tenet actually received the Medal of Freedom while he was essentially supervising this torture regime at secret sites. But those three are the classes, and Obama said very specifically in this memo that he was going to not prosecute the agents who actually did the waterboarding, who did another technique called walling, where you throw someone up against a wall and those other techniques, he wasn't going to prosecute them because he felt that they were operating in good faith based on legal advice. And that's, you know, pretty outrageous of Obama to have said. And because, you know, yes, these are the agents on the ground, but it's hard for me to believe sitting here that someone can be told to waterboard someone and do it 83 times and believe that somehow that doesn't constitute torture or that it complies with the law. Those agents had an absolute obligation to disobey an unlawful order. And it's clear those orders were unlawful. And secondly, the decision about trying those agents should not be made by Obama. The defense, if there is such a defense, of a legal advice defense, which is sort of what this amounts to, it should be tried by a jury and decide whether these people were acting in good faith. I think a jury might have trouble saying they were when you throw someone against the wall numerous times during a day. We waterboard them, put them in a box with stinging bugs, etc. So I think Obama's statement that he wouldn't prosecute is not justified. And then just to talk briefly in terms of the other categories, the legal memo writers and going up the chain of command, Rahm Emanuel, Obama's chief of staff, said on Fox, I think it was on Fox News somewhere actually, Rahm Emanuel made a statement, maybe Meet the Press, that the memo writers would not be prosecuted. And of course Obama has made noises such as, I'm not going to look backwards, I'm only going to look forward, I'm not going to be vengeful or get retribution. Of course, that's a ridiculous statement. I mean, always in a prosecution, of course, you're looking at past conduct, but you're doing it so you deter such conduct in the future. And deterrence is crucial here because, you know, the image of Obama signing those executive orders ostensibly banning torture, yeah, that great picture, loved it. But the next president, or even this one, but the next president more likely, could do the opposite and sign different executive orders. So unless you have something with teeth to say, we shall not be a nation of torture, and the next officials who torture will be prosecuted like the last ones were, we're talking about a country in which law is simply the length of the president's hand. And that's not law. And on the point you're making, I think, is the fundamental one, Scott, about what's the standard here? How do we prosecute people in Nuremberg and not here? In Obama's speech at the CIA, when he went to try and smooth some feathers for releasing the memos, Obama's speech is about how we're a country of values, we're a country of the rule of law, and even in difficult times, hard times, that's when the rule of law is important and you have to obey it. Now, that's a great statement. The problem is his failure to initiate a criminal investigation and prosecution undercuts that completely and utterly. It basically gives people who were the torture conspirators, particularly the architects, Cheney, Porter-Goss, Rumsfeld, the whole crowd of them, Tenet, Bush, Addington, it gives them impunity, and it basically sends a message that you can torture in the future and you'll get impunity for it. So it undercuts the rule of law. So on the one hand, Obama's saying, yes, the rule of law. On the other hand, he's saying the rule of law except for high officials who torture. Now, what kind of message does that send? What kind of message does it send to people in the United States, to the 2 million people who are in jail who broke the law and are in there, or most of them broke the law and are in there because they broke the law, when the highest officials in the government can break the law and do it with impunity? And what kind of message does it send to every petty dictatorship and abuser in the world that the United States can violate the fundamental prohibition on torture and the people just walk away scot-free?
Michael Radner, we had former CIA Director Michael Hayden on all these corporate media talk shows talking about how damaging the release of these torture memos were to U.S. interests, namely that he claims that these memos will be useful to Al-Qaeda terrorists. What's your response to that notion?
You know, Hayden has been outrageous, and Hayden tells you why you need prosecutions. Because Hayden and Cheney have both said, we would do it again. We think we need to do this. And that's what they're saying in that statement, that we can't let them know about this because we may need to do this again. If anything in the world screams for a need for prosecution, that is absolutely it. It also seems to me that when Hayden is saying that, he is saying that, as I said, we will torture again, but he's also saying that, yes, the CIA will be damaged. But you know what, Scott? I think the CIA needs to be damaged. I think what needs to happen here is they have to get a message. If they come close to the line of torture, they will be prosecuted. And unfortunately, the message Obama is sending is not that. Hayden and Cheney are saying we'll do it again. And two of the people, what's interesting, two of the people that Obama talked about at his CIA speech when he went over there, Steve Capps and John Brennan, who he wanted to, he started off his speech by saying, well, you guys, you see, I still have two of your people working with me that give me advice, and therefore I'm not such a bad guy about the CIA. Those two guys were implicated in the torture program. So the people that are giving advice to Obama, Capps, who is now deputy director of the CIA, and Brennan, who couldn't get the directorship of the CIA because he was so involved, is now his counterterrorism advisor on the National Security Council. So two people who basically were involved in the torture program deeply are now giving Obama advice. So you know, the problem is you really want to send the message to the CIA, which Obama hasn't sent yet, that actions have consequences.
Has the Obama administration, Michael, left the door open to investigation and prosecution of these high-level Bush administration advisors who were the architects of the torture policy?
Say that again. I'm sorry, Scott.
Has Obama left the door open to prosecuting these higher-ups? So, you know, at the same time, he says the lower-level CIA guys aren't going to be prosecuted.
Yeah, I'd like to believe that he left the door open, and, you know, some of us could argue technically that you have the statement saying he's not going to do the CIA guys who actually did the torture. Rahm Emanuel says he's not going to do the manual writers. Is he still going to do, you know, Rumsfeld, George Tenet, who got the Medal of Freedom for running the torture sites, and Cheney and those guys? You would have to say that to the extent the handwriting is on the wall, it says there's not going to be any kind of prosecution. That's for a number of reasons. One is, of course, as I said, two of the people involved in at least the CIA torture secret site work are working for Obama right now and giving him advice. And secondly, Obama has indicated in the kinds of statements he makes, we should not look backward, we should not seek retribution, that he believes that we should maybe expose some of the stuff and then just turn the page, and that his promise not to torture again is sufficient and you don't need prosecution, which for the reasons I said, just makes no sense at all. It makes no sense because it doesn't deter people in the future. And you have Hayden and Cheney out there, you know, beating the bushes to say torture, torture, torture.
We're speaking tonight on Counterpoint with Michael Radner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights, which represents many of the U.S.-held detainees at the Guantanamo Detention Center in Cuba. And Michael, we all kind of heard the news a couple weeks back where Spanish Judge Baltasar Garzon had indicated he was going to be possibly opening up an investigation into at least six of these Bush administration architects of the torture memos. It looks now like the Spanish judge, Baltasar Garzon, has been at least impeded from following through on his stated objective of opening an investigation of the higher-up Bush officials for what they did on the torture policy by the Spanish Attorney General. Do you have an update for us on that situation?
Scott, that was one of the more exciting moments I've had in the last few weeks, when Garzon opened the investigation of the six lawyers who were the architects of the torture conspiracy. And it was really exciting, and it was exciting because not only is Spain serious, it's not under the thumb of the political appointees such as the Minister of Justice, but the prosecuting judges, investigating judges like Garzon have independent authority. On the other hand, there are efforts now going on in Spain to try and kill that prosecution off. It's not so easy to do. The Attorney General, or I guess the Chief Prosecutor of Spain, said he didn't believe it should go forward, but Garzon has independent authority for it to go forward. And the latest we've heard is he has referred it up to his other fellow investigating judges to decide what to do, whether he should continue being the investigating judge or whether another investigating judge, I think there's six altogether, or eight, possibly six, should do it. The one thing I can say is it would be a shame if Garzon was not ultimately the one who did this case, because it was, as we know from the Pinochet case, he's the aggressive judge, will really go after people. The other judges, I fear, not that they'll be politically pushed that much, but that they'll be slow about going about it. And the biggest thing that could happen here, and the most important, is that the Spanish case, or a case similar possibly in another country like Italy or somewhere else, goes forward. Because what that does is that sends a message to the United States. You can't get away with giving impunity to the torturers. And it also says to the torturers, you can't travel to 25 countries in Europe. If there's an arrest warrant issued, which I'm sure Garzon would do, it would mean that those 25 countries in Europe, almost all of them would have to enforce it under the European Union rules, and that those guys cannot travel to Europe. Now, is that a big deal? Sure, it's a big deal. Haynes, for example, one of the architects of the torture, and from the Department of Defense, is now working at Chevron, and I'm sure he has to go to Europe often. It's good to know that he's going to be in great fear if he has to go. But the final word is not in on the Spanish prosecutions. Right now, what we're awaiting is a decision by the fellow investigating judges of Garzon as to whether the case should go forward and who should handle it. My guess is it will go forward. The question is whether Garzon will handle it. He is by far the best judge to handle it.
Your organization, the Center for Constitutional Rights, had a case before German courts against Donald Rumsfeld, and you wrote a book about that. Tell our listeners a little bit about the status of that case, and do you see other nations, as you said a moment ago, like Italy or Germany or other nations we haven't heard from yet, who may put additional pressure on the Obama administration to follow through and do some investigations and prosecutions here on this torture issue?
I mean, I think it's growing much more than I expected. I think both here domestically the issue is growing, as well as Europe and nation and worldwide. And when I first, and the center first came out with this position of saying, we want prosecutions, we don't want truth commissions, we don't want nothing done, we think you have to have a criminal investigation, we think that's absolutely necessary to deter torture in the future and send a message to the world, we were sort of lonely voices out there. Now there's a lot more people like that, and I think Europe, particularly under Obama, is getting a little feistier about it. Even though Obama has, you know, some pushback, and he interfered in the Spanish prosecution, unfortunately, or his administration did, to try and get that political appointee to say he didn't think it should go forward. I think that in places that have independent prosecutors like Spain, like Italy, probably a couple other countries, although those are the two best, there's some chance. Germany and France is where the Center for Constitutional Rights brought two cases. Rumsfeld was in France. We tried to get him in France. Unfortunately, the French came out with just a terrible decision about immunity for Rumsfeld, even though it was required by the torture convention that he be investigated because they had an alleged torturer on their territory, and they refused to do it. In Germany, we brought two cases against Rumsfeld and others, the torture architects, you know, the John Hughes, the Bybees of the world. And the first case was dismissed. The second one is still on appeal. I don't know what's going to happen to that case. But we've come to realize the best cases are cases like the one in Spain. Spain has an interesting interest here. You know, you hear people complain, oh, what's Spain doing here? Let the U.S. do it. This is, you know, et cetera, et cetera. It's the U.S.'s problem. It's not Spain's problem. The difference is Spain had five of its citizens or residents tortured at Guantanamo, and that gives Spain, under international law, under domestic law, under rules that everybody as lawyers accept and the legal institution accept, the absolute right to try the people who tortured their citizens and residents. The U.S. has laws like that for, you know, if terrorist acts kill American citizens, residents overseas, U.S. can bring criminal prosecutions. So the Spain prosecution in some way is clearly within even the most conservative view of the law. So I'm hopeful still that Spain will go forward, and that will, as it did in the Pinochet case, ultimately pressure the United States to bring prosecutions. Because it looks pretty bad for the United States to have a federal judge, Bybee, was head of the Office of Legal Counsel, be under possible indictment in Spain. That's not a great situation. And while we're on the subject of Bybee, actually, the center has started, along with other groups, a campaign to impeach Bybee. Bybee is the judge in the Ninth Circuit who was at the Office of Legal Counsel, the head of it, and one of these memos that was released that we've been discussing, the worst one, talking about the torture of Abu Zubaydah, was written or signed off, certainly, by Bibi. And there's an impeachment campaign that is beginning. We are actually optimistic in a way, of at least the first step of it, because it's John Conyers who can actually have a hearing on impeachment and try and get articles of impeachment passed through the House. Whether he'll do that or not, we don't know. But I would encourage your listeners to go to the Center for Constitutional website, ccrjustice.org, and go onto the website, and there's there'll be an action alert about the impeachment of Bibi. And I think it's going to have legs. It's a first and important step, because what it'll do is it'll bring out a lot of the information we need, and I think it'll compel prosecutions.
Well, I indeed hope you're right. I know you're working hard on this, Michael Radner, but I wanted to get your reaction to a lot of the former Bush administration officials that are all over the television and in some newspapers defending the torture policy, as you mentioned before. And I'm thinking right now of the American reporter, Roxana Saberi, who was convicted of spying and sentenced to 8 years in prison in Iran. Now, of course, if these same folks who defend torture for U.S.-held prisoners, I would imagine they would support Iran's torture of Roxana Saberi. Perish the thought. I mean, it's a horrible thing to even to contemplate. But, of course, their logic, you know, it inevitably leads you to a place like that, that if it's okay for U.S. to torture our prisoners, it's okay for other nations to torture U.S. prisoners.
You know, it's interesting. In a debate I had today with someone who was a former employee of the CIA, he made the argument after we got through all this stuff, like where we are now, and he said, well, they did it in good faith to protect America. And I said to him, I said, that's the worst argument I've ever heard. That's the excuse of every torturer in the world. That's the excuse of Pinochet. This is a world of law, and you obey the law even in hard times. And so the point you're making, that the precedent set by the United States, that we can torture with impunity at times of national security or times of a terrorist attack or for interests of our, you know, making us safe, is the same argument that can be used by Iran, Iraq, every torturer in the world, that basically says we torture in the name of national security, and therefore we can not obey the law. It's really the lowest level of argument, and it's the one you hear. It's the one you hear from all these guys. We needed to do it. It was a time of, you know, Al Qaeda. We have to forgive the people who did it, and go forward. You know, if you have that, you have Pinochet. You have people, you know, torturing all over the world. You have lawlessness.
Well, Michael, thank you so much, Jeff, again, for all you do. We're in your debt. And do give out the website for the Center for Constitutional Rights again. And I would advise our listeners to think hard about supporting the center, because they do so much work. They are a lone voice in the wilderness often in defending human rights, even when it's difficult in the very stilted environment here in the United States.
The ccrjustice.org, ccrjustice.org, and I really encourage people to go to the website and particularly get active on the current campaign, which is to impeach Bibi, a Ninth Circuit judge. He's actually the only real architect of torture who is currently in a federal office that required confirmation.
Yeah, what kind of message does that send to the rest of the world? That's horrifying.
So sure is, Scott.
Best of luck on that one. Michael, again, thanks for making time for us.
Thank you.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Michael Radner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights. Again, their web address is ccrjustice.org. You get information about the Impeach Bibi campaign, which seems obvious that something like that should be done. Here's this guy with his fingerprints all over these torture memos authorizing horrible abuse of prisoners, and he's a sitting federal judge. It's just amazing. Anyway, this is WPKN in Bridgeport, WPKM in Montauk. My name is Scott Harris. The program is Counterpoint. You can come to our website there at WPKN.org and get a rundown of our program schedule here. Make a secure online contribution. Find out how to volunteer. But above all, tune in and help us out. Be part of us. We are a community station and depend on listener support. And outside of that, I just want to mention that our program, Between the Lines Radio News Magazine, where many of these interviews interviews that you're hearing here in their entirety are edited down and put in the context of a shorter half-hour news magazine with a bunch of other interviews. That's available to you online at btlonline.org, btlonline.org. And we had some trouble and have had ongoing trouble with another archive I want to let you know about. That's whiterosesociety.org. They have lost our feed, but they had been archiving the two-hour counterpoint program every week for several years now. But unfortunately, we've kind of lost it. Now, it may return, so I'm just giving you that web address. You want to send a note to the folks who... actually, Ben Birch is the guy who runs that great website with archiving progressive radio programs from around the country. But if you'd like to go there, feel free to do so. And, yeah, we hope you will do that exactly. Our phone number here is 203-331-9756, 203-331-9756. And our snail mail address here at WPKN is WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. And we'll be back in just a moment with some information on what's going on in Iraq right now, stuff that you're not hearing a lot about in the corporate news media. Stay with us.
We'll get rid of the dictator, rebuild your country, make sure all your kids go to school. We'll clean up the cities, get the sewage plants running, institute parliamentary rule. We'll bring you autonomy, senators and judges, and a shiny new blue banner. We'll bring you pride and prosperity, food in your bellies, and every home a phone, fax, and scanner. After we torture our prisoners, we'll bring you decades of peace, spiritual release, free religious expression. You can say what you want in the papers you run, we'll never force a confession. After we torture our prisoners, the oil will flow just where it should go, across the desert and into the sea. You'll thank your God and the CIA that finally you are free. After we torture our prisoners, you'll all be safe with us to protect you and keep you out of harm's way. You'll thank creation and your liberation from the dark into a new day. After we torture our prisoners, you can all jump for joy, each girl and boy, and look boldly into the distance. You'll be so happy for all that we've done for such an invaluable assistance.
Well, that's a traditional and unfortunately often played song about torture from David Rovics, First We Torture Our Prisoners. Seems like I've worn out the CD. I have to get a new copy of it. Anyway, I want to welcome you to the show. If you're just tuning in, my name is Scott Harris. The program is Counterpoint. And right now, I'd like to welcome back to the program Dar Jamel, independent journalist and author of the book Beyond the Green Zone, Dispatches from an Unembedded Journalist in Occupied Iraq. Dar reported from Iraq for 8 months beginning in 2003 during the U.S. siege of Fallujah. He's just returned from another trip to Iraq, which he will tell us more about in just a moment. But Dar, thank you so much for making time to speak with us tonight.
Well, my pleasure, Scott. Good to be with you.
Yeah. I guess the way I kind of want to begin here is to take note of something I think is obvious to everybody, that with Barack Obama's election and his new focus on Afghanistan, the major corporate media, at any rate, has focused almost solely on the grave situation in Afghanistan, certainly deserving of attention, but has left the people in this country sorely served by not really taking note of what's going on in Iraq. And we're fortunate that you were just there and we can report back to us on some disturbing signs of a spike or renewed violence there, owing to a lot of instability that continues on and could get a lot worse. But maybe just tell us a little bit about the context of your recent visit to Iraq.
Well, it was my first trip back to Iraq in over 4 years' time. I actually hadn't been there almost exactly 4 years since the last time I had been there, which was February of 2005. And I went in expecting to see at least some kind of progress and was actually quite shocked to find that not only was there not any kind of progress on the ground regarding any kind of improvement in Iraqis' lives, in fact, the situation had grown much worse than when I was last there. And, you know, this contrasts with the overall message we get in the dominant media today, which says, well, things are better. And that's an assumption based solely on the metric of casualties. Well, there's less American soldiers being killed for the moment, and there's less Iraqis being killed compared to a year and a half ago, so things must be better. And while that's true, there is less overall violence, we're still looking at between six and maybe two or three dozen Iraqis being killed every day. We're still looking at a U.S. soldier being killed every other day. This is still a completely unacceptable situation, but when compared to the bloodletting of, say, mid-2007, when literally hundreds of Iraqis were being killed on a daily basis and as many as two to four American soldiers being killed every day, yes, technically you can say it's better by that one criteria. But when we set that aside and look at the overall situation, things are much, much worse. When we talk about electricity availability, clean water availability, job availability, in all of these areas, the situation for Iraqis, I found it to be far worse today than it was when I was last in there 4 years ago.
And I think you're right to say that, you know, you, like everybody else, was looking at the situation from the perspective of the casualties, of the declining number of U.S. soldiers killed and injured, of the declining number of Iraqi civilians being killed in these horrendous suicide bombings and the like. So when you actually got on the ground in Iraq, you know, just summarize for us what you saw. But in terms of the Sons of Iraq, the group that the United States placed on its payroll, the Sons of Iraq, or the Awakening Councils, as they call themselves, tell us a bit about where they are, because some reports I've seen discuss their restiveness and some signs that they may go back to the resistance and launch new attacks on the U.S. occupation forces and the Iraqi army.
Sure thing. First of all, to start with this, a little brief overview for anyone who might not be real familiar with the Al-Sawa, the Sons of Iraq. They were established actually back in mid-2006, so this is over half a year before the so-called surge strategy was launched of injecting 30,000 additional troops into Iraq. The U.S. government decided, well, we're going to basically buy off the resistance. So when we look at the overall decrease in violence today and the decrease in attacks against the American forces there, of course people think, well, this is because the surge worked. It's actually a total fallacy. The surge had little, if anything, to do with the decrease in violence. What actually caused the decrease in violence was the formation of the Sons of Iraq, the Al-Sawa. And we can even cite a RAND Corporation report, where the RAND Corporation is a U.S. Army think tank, which the report came out in April 06 and outlined, okay, we're going to basically pay off resistance fighters so that they won't keep attacking Americans, and that's exactly what was done. And so we had, by October of last year, 100,000 Sunni militiamen basically on the U.S. payroll being paid $300 a month not to attack Americans. And then these groups were disbanded by the Americans
with the promise of the Iraqi government they would be rolled over into the government security forces. What's happened instead is the government perceives these groups as a threat to their existence, because we're looking at a primarily Shia-dominated government, and they started targeting the leadership of the SAWA and many of the members of these groups. And so we have had a low-grade sort of war brewing over the last several months because of that, in addition to the fact that the government's incorporated less than 20% of these 100,000 fighters into their ranks. And so actually I've been following this very, very closely, because on a daily basis now it's been getting worse and worse. We're starting to see more and more roadside bomb attacks, more and more attacks on American forces, and a dramatic increase in the number of attacks on Iraqi government forces. And we're also seeing a dramatic increase in the number of SAWA members being killed by government forces. And this is not a surprise, because even according to the U.S. military, the vast majority of the members of the SAWA are either former resistance themselves or even members of Al-Qaeda. So when they're not being paid, and then when they're being attacked by Iraqi government forces, these people are becoming increasingly desperate. Many of them haven't been paid since October, when they were turned over to the government to be incorporated into the army and the police force. So they're facing an increasingly desperate situation, and they're starting to fight back, and we're starting to see that right now.
There have been some accusations that these Sunni groups that were on the U.S. payroll may be waiting for the U.S. to pull out to restart their insurgency against the U.S.-supported government there under al-Maliki. Do you think we're going to see some real surprises as the U.S. Under the Obama plan pulls troops out?
Well, it's really hard to say, because it's such a volatile situation, and what we're seeing right now is that a lot of these groups are not waiting that long to resume attacks. We're starting to see attacks being resumed right now. The question is, how widespread will these become? Because right now at the current trajectory, I don't see any reason why these are going to slow down. In fact, I do expect them to increase, because I do not see the Americans doing anything to back the SAWA forces again or to intervene in this growing battle of intensity between the SAWA and between the government forces. In fact, so far the military is basically just staying out of it. So I see this continuing to grow, and I really don't see any reason why it would wait for more troops to be pulled into the bases or sent over to Afghanistan. It's starting to happen right now. And another thing we have to really keep our eye on is what's happening regarding Kirkuk. We're starting to see, again, daily violent outbreaks there happening in the growing battle between where the Kurds want to basically annex Kirkuk as part of an independent Kurdistan, whereas the government of Baghdad, being primarily Arab, is absolutely not going to let that happen. So we're looking at a very real possibility of a real Kurdish-Arab civil war breaking out regarding Kirkuk, and that is a very volatile situation we have to watch too.
Do you think the Obama administration is consciously not intervening between the Sons of Iraq Sunni organizations and the al-Maliki government, or is this something that has just slipped through the cracks? Hard to imagine that, but given this, what's at stake. But where do you think the Obama folks are on this particular issue?
Well, I think the question, and I can't answer how far up the information goes, as far as does Barack Obama himself personally, is he aware of what's happening, you know, on a day-to-day basis with what's going on in Iraq? I would doubt that he's extremely tuned into it with all the other crises he has, like the economic crisis he has his hands full with right now. But certainly, without a doubt, high-ranking people in the military on the ground in Iraq are aware of what's going on, because there are places I know for a fact where the U.S. is continuing to support the SAWA as we speak. During my last trip in, I actually spent time with the leader of the entire SAWA force of Al-Anbar province, a man named Sheikh Abu Risha. He's in Ramadi. And then I also spent time with the SAWA leader of Fallujah City, a man named Sheikh Afan. And both of them are continuing to get large amounts of U.S. taxpayer money in the form of construction contracts, which then they're using to pay off fighters underneath their ranks or within their ranks. So without a doubt, the military is very, very, and I was literally at the home of Sheikh Afan, the leader of the Fallujah Awakening Group, when U.S. military Marines showed up and had a meeting with him. So without a doubt, they're aware of the position of these people, at least in Al-Anbar province, and in, certainly in parts of Baghdad. The question is then, what is the military leadership doing with this information? Because they are absolutely aware that these groups are now being attacked by Iraqi government forces. They're absolutely aware of the retaliation that will be taking place from these groups against the government forces. I think the question is then, how high up the chain of command is that information being allowed to go? And I can't answer that question.
Seen news reports that this past Saturday on the 18th of April, there was two rounds of mortar or rocket attacks on the U.S. Green Zone, the first in several months. And it looks like these attacks, if the reports are correct, were launched from the predominantly Shia sector of the city. What does this say about Shia groups that are now once again launching attacks against the U.S. occupation forces after a lull for many months?
That's another wild card that we have to keep our eye on as well. There is always the wild card. My initial suspicions would always be of the Mahdi army of Muqtada al-Sadr, because this has been an ongoing situation where throughout the entire occupation from nearly the very beginning, the U.S. has consistently, with few periods of few exceptions aside, taken the power of Muqtada al-Sadr, the Shia cleric, who staged two very large uprisings against the occupation so far. They consistently write him off and underestimate the strength of him and his militia. And while the aforementioned have certainly taken a back seat overall in the political progress and have lost a lot of their popular support and power, we're still looking at a very powerful group that does enjoy a pretty substantial amount of support, especially in certain parts of Baghdad. And so the fact that they have been making demands that are not being met, the fact that they've been making threats, they were the ones that was the group responsible for the very large demonstrations across Baghdad on April 17, the anniversary, I'm sorry, on April 9, the anniversary of the fall of Baghdad. This is all Muqtada al-Sadr, so it wouldn't surprise me to see some of the members of his militia starting to get active once again in resistance as well.
Say a few more words, if you would, about Muqtada al-Sadr, because, as you said, he's a very powerful figure. But after the Iraqi forces beat him back in Basra and in Sadr City in Baghdad, as well as some losses in recent provincial elections, as you said, a lot of observers are writing him off. Speak to maybe what kind of power does Muqtada al-Sadr have to disrupt what's going on there currently on the ground in Iraq, and politically, what role do you think he'll be playing in the future as the U.S. Redeploys certain troops and reduces its footprint there in Iraq?
Well, for example, we have to keep in mind Muqtada al-Sadr has such a large base, because his base is basically comprised of people who grew up in Iraq under the U.S.-backed sanctions that killed over 500,000 Iraqi children. This is his base. They're the poor, the impoverished of Iraq, the people who grew up in the really desperate areas and during the desperate times. And he has a very large militia because of this. Now, these are not well-trained, well-armed people in his militia. Most of them, in fact, have had no training whatsoever. But we're talking about very, very large numbers of people. And I've seen his militia, a lot of his militiamen myself during my trips to Iraq, where literally it's comprised of teenagers or other young men wearing sandals that, given an order at any particular time, would just grab their AK-47 machine gun and run out the door and do what they were told to do. That's basically what his militia is. So when we've had these two uprisings, while there hasn't been massive numbers of casualties inflicted upon American forces, certainly it causes massive disruptions, and they are able to shut down large parts of the country at any given time. And we've seen this happen numerous times throughout the occupation. So that is still a real threat, and also because of the size of his following, we're talking millions of Iraqis, literally, and because of how the large number of them that happen to be centered in Baghdad, like in Sadr City, for example, of course, which needless to say, the vast majority of the people living there are Sadr loyalists, we're talking about half the population of the capital city. A capital city of 6 million people are right there in Sadr City, and that's the area where it was suspected these recent mortars came from that struck the so-called green zone. So at any given time, you know, this is an individual that he'll lay quiet for several months, and then he's consistently had a habit of it at the worst possible time for the Americans or at a really critical time popping his head up and causing a lot of trouble. So we certainly can't write that possibility off.
We're speaking tonight here on Counterpoint with Dar Jamal, independent journalist and author, and he just returned from a trip to Iraq again, where he had been before, and that's upon which he based his book. That's titled Beyond the Green Zone, Dispatches from an Unembedded Journalist in Occupied Iraq. Dar, to better understand the political situation in Iraq, maybe you can report on the results of the provincial elections and what it tells us. And among those results, as we spoke about, Muqtada al-Sadr and his party did not do that well. Maybe just explain where you think things are headed in terms of the Iraqi population. I hear that the Shia-Sunni divide is really not where things are at in terms of politics there, but there's a lot more complex and nuanced set of rivalries at play.
Well, there are, and more of the rivalries now are within the different sectarian groups and even some of the ethnic groups. We have a lot of fighting amongst the Kurdish groups, for example. There's never been anything like real solidarity between Barzani and Talabani, the two main Kurdish leaders, that basically each one of them controls half of Kurdistan as though they're a sort of gangster for that half of Kurdistan. I mean, literally, there's even two different cell phone networks for Kurdistan. You can't have just one cell phone that works in each portion controlled by each leader. There's not a lot of love lost between these two individuals. And then similarly, in the Shia camp, we look at a lot of infighting where the broad Shia coalition that really came into power in the January 05 elections, now when we look at these most recent provincial elections just this past January in Baghdad and across the country, except for Kurdistan, they didn't have provincial elections there. But within these provincial elections, we're starting to see that Shia coalition is really breaking up, where we have different Shia groups are vying for power. We have the Dawah Party kind of going one direction. We have the Supreme Iraqi Islamic Council going another direction. We have the Al-Fadila Party, and we have the Sadr movement going two other directions, and they're all battling amongst themselves for control of certain parts of ministries in Iraq, of control of certain provinces and cities, and we're certainly seeing this battle amongst the Shia, for example, very widespread across the south. And then when we look within the Sunni, we have now the Sons of Iraq now trying to get more political power themselves. They're going up against the Iraqi Islamic Party, which was already somewhat entrenched in provincial power seats from the January 2005 elections, because they were basically the only Sunni group that participated. Everyone else had boycotted. But now all of the other Sunni groups that boycotted are trying to step back into the process and get more power. So within each group, we have a whole lot of power play and struggle going on, a lot of that even resulting in violence. And then on top of that is when we start looking at the broader fact that there still is sectarianism in Iraq, unfortunately, but it's kind of an under-the-cover sectarianism. And it kind of, while we don't have the massive bloodletting that resulted from this from early 2006 to mid-2007, probably the most violent period of the entire occupation, because it was there was massive violent sectarianism going on. Instead of that, we still have, while sectarianism has become a dirty word in Iraq, we still have a low-grade kind of fear and paranoia between Sunni neighborhoods and Shia neighborhoods, because there was so much destruction and suffering caused by that violence a couple of years ago. People are very afraid, and they're traumatized by it, and they're very afraid of the possibility of that coming back. So it's something that nobody wants to talk about. and everyone likes to pretend that it's over, but everyone deep down inside is still very, very leery of the possibility it could happen again, and that's why they're very afraid of anything in the political sphere that might generate that. And this is really, I think, the primary reason why Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki won power in these provincial elections, because he was playing the nationalist card. He was playing a card of unity. I will unify Iraq. We will not have sectarianism. And that's why people voted for him, and he did so well in the elections.
Do you view him as a strong leader, even as the U.S. reduces its troop presence there?
No, not at all. In fact, we have a recent development where there's a new Sunni Speaker of the Parliament who's one of Maliki's greatest rivals. I see a lot of problems and fragmentation happening within his own government and him starting to lose control. And while he played the nationalist card to come to so much more power in the recent elections, I really don't see it working out for him, because more and more Iraqis are starting to turn against him as they see, look, he's not, you know, again, these promises of withdrawal, we're not seeing it. Promises of better services and unity and reconciliation, we're not seeing it. Instead, we're starting to see Maliki moving forward with what we were talking about earlier, with an ongoing attack posture towards the Sawa, for example, and this is starting to really destabilize things in the security realm, which also is the thing that that brought him so much popularity in the last election, is he took credit for stabilizing the security situation in Iraq, and a small portion of that is true. Most of it's not Maliki. It doesn't have anything to do with him, but he convinced people that he had something to do with that, and now that is slowly but surely on a daily basis starting to worsen, and that's certainly not going to help his ability to get people to continue to trust him over time.
Before you leave, Dr. Jamil, I wanted to sort of tap into what you certainly do best, and that is report on what the average person in Iraq is thinking and feeling, and how they're viewing the situation in their very damaged country. Maybe you could leave us with a story of a person or a family that you met with and some of their concerns for the future, given the changes that are afoot with the U.S. Troop presence and this recent escalation of violence. You have something you can leave us with that would sort of better give us a feel for the emotional side of this thing?
Well, I think I would talk about the interpreter I was working with my last trip, a middle-aged man. His name is Ali. Very, very kind-hearted individual. He's worked as an interpreter with the New York Times and many other big outlets, and very, very good at what he does as far as getting us access and helping us find stories. And he is a man who, he's married, he has three daughters, and he's doing his best to get by in an increasingly difficult situation. I think the big problem, one of the biggest problems now facing Iraqis, is economically it's become extremely difficult to live there. While, for example, Ali, we were paying him $100 a day to work with us, which in Iraq is an extremely good payment for Iraqis, where the average salary of an Iraqi, for example, policeman is about $150 a month. Doctors are making maybe $300 to $500 a month. So he was being paid well by Iraqi standards, and yet he was desperate because he said, look, I'm working for you guys 6 days a week, and yet it's, you know, gas now. It costs me as much to fill up my car here as it does to you in the States, so it's costing me like $35 to fill up my car, which I have to do once or twice a week. The cost of food has gone up 5, 6, 7 times since even just a year ago. So it's become very, very difficult for them to make ends meet. And he goes from one job to the next, no guarantee that when I leave there's going to be another journalist step in and hire him and work for several weeks as well. So he's struggling, and he doesn't really see any relief in sight. He worries about his wife and his daughters, and he worries about his own security, but he has to keep working. And this is the situation of so many Iraqis, those even lucky enough that had jobs at the moment, where sometimes unemployment in Iraq on any given month could be as high as 50, 60, even 70%. In some cities, it's even higher than that. So it's a very desperate situation, on top of the fact that half of the people in Baghdad don't even have access to clean drinking water. The medical infrastructure is still quite devastated. So it's really a kind of daily struggle just to have basic needs met for the average Iraqi today.
All right, Darrell, thank you so much for your reports. I'm glad you're back safe from Iraq. And our listeners can read your articles online at your website, which is darjamaliraq.com, correct?
That's correct.
And it's Dar Jamal's Middle East Dispatches. And, again, it's Dar, darjamaliraq.com. And anything else you want to leave us with, Dar?
No, just thanks again very much for having me, Scott, and I appreciate you spending the time talking about Iraq.
Yep, appreciate you being there to hear some of these unspoken details and currents going on there. So take care. We'll hope to have you back here soon.
Okay, thanks again. You too.
Bye-bye. Dar Jamal, independent journalist and author. Again, his book is titled Beyond the Green Zone, Dispatches from an Unembedded Journalist in Occupied Iraq. And again, that's darjamaliraq.com to read his more recent articles. We're going to take a musical break and be back in just a little bit with a discussion of what took place down in the Trinidad-Tobago Latin American Summit meeting between the U.S., the Latin American general, and handshake between President Barack Obama and Hugo Chavez and the rabid right, and how they view that whole, that 7-second handshake that sent shivers down the spine of Republicans like Nevada Senator John Ensign. We'll be talking about that with Mark Weisbrot in just a moment. Of course, and also the possible coming thaw between U.S.-Cuba relations, where we're not getting a lot of optimism from Mark in our interview tonight, but you'll hear it for yourself. Stay tuned. This is WPKN in Bridgeport at 89.5 FM and WPKM in Montauk, New York at 88.7 FM. Our website is WPKN.org. Speaking with Mark Weisbrot, co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research based in Washington, D.C. Mark, thanks so much for joining us tonight. Appreciate you being here.
Sure, thank you.
Why don't you give us your impression of what could prove to be a very important and possibly a landmark Latin American summit meeting that took place in Trinidad and Tobago over the past weekend. Tell us what you thought about some of the signs of a thaw between the U.S. and Cuba and the U.S. and Venezuela.
Well, I don't think there's really much there. I think it was good in the sense that Obama showed that he was willing to listen, and he showed that he had a different attitude than Bush, which we, you know. But other than that, you know, in the images that flashed around the world, the, you know, front page of the New York Times of Obama shaking hands with Chavez and laughing and joking with them, and really inflamed the right wing here in the United States and around the world. But I don't think that there was necessarily any substantive change. And I think the reason is more structural.
How do you mean structural? What are the U.S. interests or corporate interests in the region that you think may prevent a thawing of relations?
Well, you know, it isn't even corporate. It's ironically, it's more narrow than that. It's just a kind of a foreign policy establishment that still sees Latin America as belonging to the United States and hasn't really recognized the huge the changes that have taken place over the last 10 years. And, you know, the one sign of this, if you look at Obama's advisors, Jeffrey Davidoff was a career Foreign Service officer, was in Chile in the embassy, U.S. embassy in the coup back in 1973, served under Reagan and Nixon. And he's the guy who Obama chose to organize the summit. He was special ambassador for the summit. And he was immediately talking to the press right after Obama shook hands with Chavez, trying to do, I don't know what you call the opposite of damage control. Maybe you could call it repair control. And he was insulting Chavez. He said that, trying to provoke him. That's what, they do this a lot, actually. And Chavez usually takes the bait, unfortunately. He said, well, you know, Chavez just wanted to get close to Obama because Obama is more popular in Venezuela than Chavez is. And, you know, he made it clear, as he did before the summit, too, that that nothing's going to change. And I think until Obama gets rid of people like him, you're not going to see very much. It isn't like, you know, for example, I mean, you look at on the other side, on the domestic side, where he hires people like Larry Summers and Tim Geithner, and, you know, they're from the Clinton administration, and they did, you know, people have pointed out on the left especially that these guys were responsible for some of the mess that we're looking at today. And so there's a certain similarity there, but, you know, these guys really have to do something at least somewhat different than what they did in the 90s, and they are. It's not necessarily the right thing. But on the other hand, in foreign policy, there's no real pressure in the United States. You know, there's no political constituency that has a real voice, especially in the media, that can pressure the foreign policy establishment to change it. You know, we're kind of like Russia in the sense of, you know, on foreign policy issues, we don't have an independent civil society that has access to the media for the most part. And so even though most Americans would like to see better relations with the rest of the world, including Latin America, and they have no stake in the embargo or bad relations with Chavez or anything else, you find here is Obama, you know, leaving the decisions to these people who are really, in Davidoff's case, he's practically a neoconservative.
Mark Weisbrot, when you look at the Republican reaction to that seven-second handshake between Obama and Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez, it does certainly speak to what you're saying. It does indicate that Obama's up. He's going to confront a lot of challenges for any substantial change in U.S. policy toward either Venezuela or Cuba.
Yeah, but it would be very easy for him to brush that stuff off if he didn't have people on his own team that feel the same way. That's the problem. If he appointed some decent people and he could just say to Newt Gingrich, well, you know, what did you do to improve relations with Latin America? Do you think overthrowing the government of Venezuela in 2002, that was the way to go about it? Do you think that has anything to do with the hostility that we're facing? I mean, it's very easy to answer these people. And again, it's not like, it's not even like on the financial side where you have these huge Wall Street interests. You know, these are just people who have no, you know, there's no big stakes there. There's, you know, maybe the oil companies in Venezuela, but, you know, they pretty much, for most of the last 10 years, they've accepted that Chavez is going to be there, and they are certainly accepting it now that, you know, now that he won the referendum saying that, you know, he can run for re-election whenever he wants. And so it isn't. It really is this kind of foreign policy establishment that just changes only glacially.
We heard Republican Senator John Ensign from Nevada to talk about how irresponsible it was for Barack Obama to shake hands with Chavez when Chavez handed him the book, The Open Veins of Latin America, Five Centuries of the Pillage of a Continent, a book by Edward Galeano. Tell our listeners just a little bit about that book, because, you know, in some media it's being sort of dismissed as some leftist tract.
Well, it's a great book, and it's, I think, you know, most educated people in Latin America, very many of them have read it. And Galeano, of course, is quite a famous author. And, you know, it just tells the story of how Latin America was pillaged since the conquest, you know, first, of course, by the Spanish Empire, but then later by the United States. And I think it goes all the way to when the book was written, which I believe was in the late 70s. And, of course, it wouldn't be that hard to update it either, because our Latin America policy has not changed very much. The main thing that happened in the last 10 years is that you have a whole new generation of leaders that were elected in, you know, Argentina, Brazil, Venezuela, Bolivia, Paraguay, Uruguay, Nicaragua, Honduras, El Salvador, and all of these presidents have a different attitude, and they've begun to institutionalize it from their point of view. They want to be treated as equals. They want to be treated, you know, kind of like Europe is treated by the United States. That's how they see themselves in terms of regional economic integration, for example. They see the European Union as a model. And they don't consider the United States has the right to dictate their foreign policy or their domestic economic policy, which it has done all too often in the last century and a half. And so this is a sea change. This is huge, an epoch-making change. And this is what these people don't understand. I mean, if you read the New York Times from Saturday, for example, you know, the article reports that Latin Americans were upset about being ignored under the Bush administration. Well, that was actually the good news. They didn't mind being ignored at all. What they didn't like is the various interventions, including the coup in Venezuela, the coup that overthrew the democratically elected government of Haiti in 2004, the support for opposition groups from the United States and Bolivia. These are the things, and of course the attempts to force these regional trade agreements, Free Trade Area of the Americas, which was pretty much buried in 2005. These are all the things that these, not only the heads of state, but the people who elected them have really rebelled against. And it's not just blind nationalism, and they're rebelling against it because they voted the old political classes out of office because there was a huge, unprecedented economic failure that lasted now almost 30 years, since 1980. So these are some of the things, I think, that are understood south of the border, but they're not well understood in Washington. That's why you have this huge gap. And Obama is doing a little bit to bridge it. I mean, he's saying he's willing to listen. He did respond to Evo Morales, who said that the U.S. should denounce the latest attempt, which he says was an attempt to assassinate him. And Obama did that. He said that the United States very clearly is against violence, against coups. And so, you know, he's responding as much as he can at the level of speech and symbolism without making any commitments to change U.S. foreign policy towards the region.
We're speaking with Mark Weisbrot, co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research. Mark, when it comes to free trade, Barack Obama during the campaign and since the campaign's ended has given mixed signals on really what he wants to do with free trade. And I believe at this summit meeting in Trinidad and Tobago, he met with Colombian President Uribe and talked about trying again to pass a Colombia Free Trade Agreement, an agreement that as senator, Barack Obama had opposed for some good reasons in terms of the violence against civilians and journalists and unionists.
Yes, and that is a disturbing sign. Again, it indicates, it shows the advisors that he has. That's they're not all that different from the advisors that the Bush administration had and on Latin America, and so they favor these agreements. And again, Obama is still the boss. He can overrule these people, but the problem is that he will on some issues. I mean, I think, you know, if something comes to be politically unpalatable, like the Colombia Free Trade Agreement is an issue where he might go against his advisors. But right now, as you said, he does not need to accept them. But, you know, the problem is that he has two shooting wars in the Middle East, and he's got the Pakistan, the Israel-Palestine conflict on the foreign policy front. And then he has, most importantly, you know, is looking more and more like a depression in the United States. And these are the things that he's going to be most concerned with, and especially, I think you can see this from all of his foreign policy, which is relatively conservative. You can see that he's made a decision, which is a rational political decision for someone who wants to get reelected, that his presidency will be judged on what happens here with the domestic economy, and that's going to be his main priority. And so even though this doesn't necessarily follow logically, he seems to have decided that the safest thing to do, if this is going to be the basis on which your presidency is judged, is to move as little as possible on foreign policy, because he sees that as the least amount of political risk. And so that's why you're not seeing much in the way of change on foreign policy.
Mark,
when I say that, I mean change from the second, you know, the last couple of years of the Bush administration, because the Bush administration did move, you know, it started out very neoconservative and extreme, and it ended up more towards the centrist foreign policy that is the standard foreign policy in Washington. And I think that's what I mean by Obama's foreign policy being similar, but it's especially true in Latin America.
Mark, we see in terms of some of the pre-conference dialogue going on between Barack Obama and Raul Castro that the U.S. Was willing to ease up on the remittances being sent from Cuban Americans to their families in Cuba, as well as expanding the visits that they can take to the island to visit family. But, of course, the big issue here is the 47-year embargo. And at the summit meeting, we had Mexico and Brazil offering to act as intermediaries to try and bridge the gap on ending that embargo, which is very unpopular across Latin America and across the world. Do you think that any changes to the embargo can be made here in Barack Obama's first term, given the influence that Cuban Americans have traditionally had in a key electoral state such as Florida? But, of course, we also understand that attitudes are changing among Cuban Americans, that more are now in favor of constructive engagement towards Havana than the older generation, which is, you know, sort of losing ground.
Yeah. Well, first of all, I think the lifting of the travel restrictions and the remittance restrictions for the and the some of the telecom restrictions, but the travel restrictions are only for Cuban Americans, same for remittances. And that's something that the right-wing Cuban American groups in Florida, at least the most important ones, agree with. So that was not controversial, and that was something that didn't cost Obama anything. And that's, I think, as far as he's going to go. Now, because he doesn't want to take the risk that, you know, Florida could end up being a swing state again in the next presidential election. And that doesn't mean it stops there, because Congress has a different attitude. The majority of Congress probably wants to lift the travel restrictions as the next step for everybody in the United States. And, you know, that's kind of almost a civil liberties issue. There is a civil liberties issue, too, for the United States. I mean, we're one of the few I think we might be the only high-income country in the world that has a government that doesn't allow freedom of travel for its citizens. And so that's an issue that I think Obama would have a hard time vetoing if it came to his desk. So you might still see some further progress, but it won't come from, it doesn't look like it's going to come from the administration, again, unless he decides to get rid of his current advisors and get a new set of advisors. With regard to the Cuban-American float, it's true, opinions are changing, attitudes have changed for quite a while. But I think the problem is that the right-wing Cuban-American groups, Cuban-American National Foundation, for example, they're more organized, they have money, and the older Cuban-Americans who are more conservative vote in greater numbers than the younger ones. So if you just look at the polls, yeah, you do have, for the first time, a majority, a slight majority, that want to lift the entire embargo. But that isn't enough, I think, for a cautious politician to say, okay, we can move ahead now in response to popular opinion, even in the Cuban-American, community.
Barack Obama, you know, talking about future relations with Cuba, has spoken about the need for Cuba to release political prisoners, reduce the fees on the remittances sent by American families to their kin in Cuba. Do you see Raul taking action or any kind of dramatic departure from traditional Cuban policy on this? Or, as you read in a lot of the corporate press, do you think Fidel will have to pass on before Cuba really takes a different path?
Oh, I don't think that Raul and Fidel necessarily even differ on this. It's kind of hard for them as a sovereign country to cave in or even appear to be caving in to U.S. pressure on things that they consider to be internal matters. So I think that's the problem for them. Obviously, you know, Cuba and everybody in Latin America knows the United States doesn't care at all about democracy in Cuba, or Washington doesn't anyway. And so the whole thing seems rather farcical to them. Also, if you add in that the United States has Guantanamo there still, and even if they close down the prison, they still have this base that the Cubans don't want there. It's there against their will. They signed a treaty 100 years ago, but that was with a, you know, completely different kind of non-independent government. So, they don't, I don't see them, they're not in a hurry to make concessions, because it isn't like the United States is demanding something of them that they can see as a legitimate U.S. interest. You know, it would be different if they wanted, they're willing to cooperate on the war on drugs and things like that. And they're happy to do that because that they see as a legitimate interest for both countries. But the United States tries to tell them, you know, what kind of political system they should have. They're not, that doesn't really go anywhere with them.
Well, just a final question here. You touched on this earlier about Americans and their public opinion. But when it comes to Latin America and the, you know, very rocky and sometimes violent history of U.S. intervention in Latin America, where do you think public opinion is at, and how most effectively can Americans speak up to put some pressure on the Obama administration to really change direction from the Cold War rhetoric and policies that have really been the standard all these many decades?
No, I think the weak points, if you're looking for the pressure, what are the points where you could possibly win? I think the travel ban on Cuba is a weak one. There you've got, as I said, you've got a majority in Congress. People could lobby for that. I think one thing that would really help, because this is why U.S. relations are so bad, and U.S.-Latin American relations are so bad, is because the United States still is intervening there. You know, in Bolivia, for example, USAID keeps is funding, putting $89 million a year into Bolivia, U.S. Agency for International Development. That's an amount that, relative to the Bolivian economy, is equivalent to what we spend on the Iraq War. And they won't disclose where it's going. They've admitted that some of it's going to opposition groups. We don't know how much to whom, because of the violent ones. We don't even know that. And the United States won't disclose that. So that's something, you know, the Obama administration has pledged to respect the Freedom of Information Act and comply with it. There's been requests filed under those for years, and the USAID refuses to disclose this information. So that's something, I think, if they come clean on the kind of stuff that it really is an offense to the Bolivian government, which they see as a direct interference in their internal affairs and a support for a right-wing opposition and sometimes even an illegitimate opposition. That's the kind of thing I think would make a difference, and I think that's something that citizens here can reasonably also demand, because it's also a civil liberties issue for us. We really should know where our tax dollars are going. USAID is not a clandestine organization. It's not the CIA, for example, which didn't excuse it, but I mean, it doesn't even have that excuse, for this kind of secrecy. So those are some of the things that I think people could push for in the near future, given that, again, the Obama administration's main advisors are not predisposed to any substantive change right away.
Well, Mark, thank you so much for sharing your thoughts on what could be an important break, maybe not, as you're saying, with the people surrounding Obama, but as you said, the missing ingredient is public pressure. How can our listeners get more information about your group, the Center for Economic and Policy Research?
Well, everything we write is on our website. It's at cepr.net. That's Center for Economic and Policy Research.
cepr.net. Again, Mark, thanks so much for sharing time with us. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Music from the Cuban group Los Van Van, taking us out of that interview with Mark Weisbrot of the Center for Economic and Policy Research that we conducted a little earlier tonight. And right now, to close off our Counterpoint program tonight, we're going to bring you one of the highlights of this past weekend's Left Forum, a gathering of academics and activists. We had one of the organizers of the gathering this past Monday evening to talk about that with us. And I had gone to New York on Saturday and visited some of the discussion panels and brought back some of the discussion there on a range of topics. And in fact, I'll just mention this up front and at the end of this particular segment, that we have posted some of those audio files of the discussion panels from the Left Forum on our website, the Between the Lines Radio News website, and that's btlonline.org. So go there at the top of the page. There are some files there now, and some will be added later this week. But it's btlonline.org. So if you're interested in the Left Forum, the Left Forum actually had been known for many years in past decades as the Socialist Scholars Conference. Changed their name back, I think it was 2004, 2005, and it's a pretty similar lineup of folks from all over the country. And the panel that we're going to hear to close out the program tonight is titled The Obama Campaign and the Presidency, The Lessons for the Left. Moderating the panel was Bill Fletcher, Jr., Center for Labor Renewal, and a contributor to The Black Commentator. Professor Stanley Aronowitz, a professor of sociology at the Graduate Center, City University of New York. Also there was Gihan Pereira, the Miami Workers Center, and the Right to the City Alliance. Frances Fox Piven was also part of this panel. She's a professor of political science, nationally known, and she works there at the Graduate Center for the City University of New York. And lastly, Barbara Epstein, a history of consciousness professor at the University of California, Santa Cruz. And actually, the moderator, Bill Fletcher, put the question to the panel that we're going to hear right now. And the question was, what are some of the major lessons that the left can learn from the Obama campaign? And leading off that answer is Barbara Epstein. So we're going to take a listen to that right now. Barbara Epstein answering the question, lessons for the left from the Obama campaign.
I think the lesson that would occur to me is, first of all, that there is a reservoir of enthusiasm for progressive change among young people that a lot of us have not appreciated. And I also think that there's a reservoir of enthusiasm for opposition to racism among young people, especially urban young people, which we also haven't appreciated, and that those two things need to be built on.
Thank you. Stanley? Stanley Aronowitz.
Barbara stole my thunder. I actually thought that the little anecdote I mentioned at the beginning is that Obama succeeded. The Obama campaign succeeded in mobilizing 18 to 30-year-olds in ways that have not been done in decades. And what I think we should learn from it is that, with all due respect to all of us oldies, golden oldies, and others, that unless and until the left has an approach to organizing youth, it's going to be up the creek without a paddle. I started out as a political activist at the age of 15. I was part of a high school student strike, which my friend Mark Solomon was part of, and he's here, in New York City. We were high school students, and he did, in fact, energized large numbers of high school and college students in ways that I think it was unimaginable from the point of view of the last 30 years. And we don't talk about youth organizing and what the specific characteristics are of young people that would make them friendly to a left appeal, whether or not they were. But the Obama campaign was very clever, and they did it. And I think that's the main lesson.
Yeah.
So, just on the last thing, we at the Worker Center mobilized voters and didn't take a position. I did.
Gihan Pereira.
Personally, for the reasons I said. The second thing is on the youth question. I think this is really important. In Florida, at least, I think when there was exit polls done, and in fact, white youth voted predominantly for McCain. There's a huge myth that everyone that had an iPod voted for Obama, and that was actually not true, and it shocked me as a lesson. So one, I think that the question of race, and if you look at what happened in terms of race, particularly, and then race and gender, secondly, is a huge tale. And I think it comes back to the thing of, like, we have to build with national, with groups who are nationally oppressed, with blacks and Latinos and Asian Americans. In Florida, those were the people who became the most activated, that made a difference for all the reasons that we know. And if we don't, if we keep somehow forgetting about race at the level of base and who's going to be the real agents here, we're going to blow it every time.
I just have to say that in Ohio and Pennsylvania, what you had in Florida was not true. That is, youth voted heavily in parts of Pennsylvania and Ohio for Obama. And that, you know, so that you have regional differences and you have differences in the kind of campaigns that were conducted.
Sam?
Bill, I'm not sure this is the most important lesson, but certainly one lesson that was...
Frances Fox Piven.
taught by the Obama campaign and actually reiterated the lessons of the 2000 campaign and the 2004 campaign, which is has to do with the profound and sweeping distortions in the American voting system, and particularly the role of race, of racial vote suppression in those distortions. We sort of know that the 2000 election was stolen, and it was stolen largely in reaction to a black voting rights mobilization in Florida. We should know that the 2004 election was probably stolen, and it was stolen mainly in Ohio. In the weeks before the election of 2008, a lot of people were worried about massive vote suppression, vote caging, the destruction of voter registrations, and classical stuff like that. And Obama won, so we think it didn't happen. No, that isn't the best storyline to come out of the 2008 election. The best storyline is that Obama's margin was big enough to overcome the votes that were won by cheating, and cheating particularly at the expense of black voters. Now, that's one thing we might get Obama to fix. You know?
So, thank you. So what I'd like to do is now transition to the Obama presidency. And we're now almost 90 days since he was inaugurated. And I'd like to ask each of you to say very briefly, what do you think the scorecard looks like? Gihan?
Well, it's mixed. My point earlier was that I wasn't disappointed because I didn't expect a hell of a lot. And I didn't expect a hell of a lot, particularly in the absence of mass pressure from the bottom and the left in American society. His stimulus bill has some very good elements in it, particularly compared to the way in which budget policy has been changed over the years of the Reagan, Bush, and Clinton administrations, and then the second Bush administration. The new budget is also an improvement. Some of the programs are being restored that matter to ordinary people, to working people. The release of the documents by the Justice Department under the banner of transparency. Transparency in government is a good thing. And although Obama is too crafty to threaten to prosecute these guys himself, he's paved the way for the Spanish judge to prosecute them. So some things are okay. A lot of things I don't like. I don't like the fact that his health care plan is so modest and easily corruptible. After all, the health care industry is so powerful, it's going to take an enormous push to get there. I'm worried about whether Obama's going to use his political muscle for the Employee Free Choice Act. Is he really going to use political capital for that? If not, it's a really serious problem. His foreign policy is very, very mixed. I don't like his Afghan policy. I half don't like his Iraq policy. But he just might move against the military budget. Now, that would be a good thing over the long haul, because if we could slash that military budget, not only would we have all the money to spend on economic development in the United States, and especially economic development for people at the bottom in the United States, but by slashing the military budget, we would starve the interest groups that every year push that military budget up. That's what we should try to do. Barney Frank, to my surprise actually, took a very strong position on cutting military spending. Maybe we could get Obama to do that as well.
I'd like to pass for the moment.
Sam.
Well, I think the main difference between, apart from everything that we've said, between Obama and Hillary Clinton was that one had major support of the of Merrill Lynch, and the other had major support of Goldman Sachs. But that's a metaphor for what I think the main tendency of the economic policy is. You may say there are some good things here and there, but essentially this is a massive continuation of the policies of the other person in Goldman Sachs, whose name is Hank Paulson, who was Bush's Secretary of Treasury. Geithner was part of that operation that gave all this money to the bank bailout. I don't think that anybody on this platform would have thought that Obama would do anything else. But, you know, there is one thing that we could have expected, and I want to talk about scorecard, I really do, in a minute. And one of the things we could have expected is that on questions of civil liberties, the Obama administration would begin to make something of a break. And the problem is the continuation, although Obama has said he'll shut down Guantanamo, he may transfer those prisoners to Afghanistan. He has not been willing to say that anybody who committed illegal acts by the CIA, CIA people, would be brought up for prosecution. There is every indication that Holder, who was a complicated corporate lawyer, as the Attorney General, is going to continue many of the policies of the Bush administration. In fact, I think on issues of national security, on issues of defense, I think Fran is right, that the Obama administration is not prepared to break with those policies of the Bush administration. And I would argue that on those issues of international of national defense, as well as of the economy, at least at the, on the broadest level, there is continuation of the Bush administration. Having said that, please, just one more thing. Having said that, I think that the willingness to talk to Iran, the willingness to deal with the problem of Cuba, are very important indications that he's inching up to it, something of a break. If anybody can settle the Middle East question, the Palestinian question, it's Hillary Clinton, because she's such a fucking hawk. And she would not be expected to do that. It's only a Hillary Clinton, actually, who can actually intervene in the Palestinian question. And that's because she's so bad on those questions historically. She belongs to the Israeli lobby. And I think that's why, to a certain extent, she is Secretary of State.
Yeah.
I agree with Stanley. And even on the youth question, I tell you I support his daughter. So, you know, the thing that I wanted to focus on was particularly the question of the economy and the stimulus, right? I mean, there's two things that confound me around this question. One is because we could not have imagined the amount of billions and zeros of dollars that are being poured in by the government in this stimulus, right? And so just the staggering number of zeros almost overwhelms you that it's so different than what's before. But in fact, all of those zeros are poured into the exact same economic structures and are poured into the exact same bureaucratic state structures that have been there before. So in a lot of states, in Florida, for example, the money is largely subsidizing budget cuts that were happening that were previous, right? It's like it gets us almost back to zero, right? Is one. Two is that in the education system, in the housing system, it's pouring money into systems that are broken and, you know, and just putting more money into them. I think there's a real question then for us about how we like the money that's been poured into the banks, like the money that's poured into the states, like the money that's been poured into educations. I think we have significant demands that we can make on that money in ways that should really radicalize and change the very structures of those of the education system, of the housing system, of all of this money that's going in the banks. I think David Harvey on a panel earlier today just said that we should basically take over Bank of America, and I think Peter Marcuse added that, you know, we should go with our tax, our 1040s, to show that we own the thing, because that's the amount of money that's been put into it. But I think we need to be able to take ownership of how much money has gone into something that's largely unaccountable, and in particular won't actually get down to particularly communities of color and low-income communities.
Okay, did you want to say that?
Okay, what I will add is I agree with everybody that it's a very mixed record. What I see is that Obama has been extremely cautious. I wish he hadn't been as cautious as he's been. I nevertheless think that in all of the areas that we're talking about, the fact that he has made any steps at all helps to delegitimize a reigning ideology that it was not possible to delegitimize under the Bush administration. And that's both in terms of the need for regulation, the need for government spending in order to restart the economy, and the need for some sort of shift in foreign policy, even though there's no arena in which that's gone anywhere near enough to satisfy any of us. At least the question is raised. And for 8 years, it was impossible for us to raise those questions.
Thank you. I want to ask you guys if we can go to 9:15 instead of ending at 9. Is that right? Thank you. A number in talking. Now I conducted a scientific poll. So I guess what I wanted to ask is that a number of folks, in general, have talked about the need to keep pressure on the administration and issues of accountability, and that's very good rhetoric. Question is, what does that mean in reality, Gian?
Well, I mean, I think we've said, I agree that that's pressure. There's also, and I agree with what Barbara said, there's also a number of other places, just because there's so much going on, that there may be low-hanging fruit in terms of things that we want changed that we may be able to get done. Right, and so I think those things we have to go after, and I think there may be actually openings to get some of those things done. I think there's two different types of pressure, and I think one is, I think there's some sense that there could be an inside track with Obama to try and kind of negotiate with key people inside the administration to move some of this stuff. I think that we have to be clear that there actually seems to be much more access now, but that doesn't mean influence or power. And so I think we have to be very guarded but very strategic in figuring out how we use that access, both to figure out what's going on and to figure out where the places are that we can make intervention. Two is then we have to build organizations on the ground that can push the issues. I think the one that I see rearing up to actually push the quickest now is actually on the immigration front, where those folks, where the immigration had been punted, and there was a great fear that immigration wasn't going to get out with it all, that movement is ready to kind of, you know, really pick up the task and get back on it. And I think that's the first place I see.
Well, I would agree with the strategy of picking some small number of issues. I don't think that a broad front of issues is going to test the Obama administration in any significant way. To the immigration issue and question, of course, you do have an incipient mass movement there. I would add the issue of single payer. I think that the health plan of the Obama administration is so weak And the fact that there's an enormous amount of grassroots support for 676 now, over 500 unions have come out for it. The AMA, National Health Care Coalition, that would be a very important place to put those things on the table. And I think that would test the question. I think that would test the question of whether a movement of this size would actually begin to influence the administration, or whether the insurance companies in the last analysis will have the upper hand. And one more thing. Remember, we like to romanticize the New Deal. Remember that the Social Security legislation 1935 and the National Labor Relations Act of 1935 followed a huge strike wave, general strike in San Francisco, general strike in Minneapolis, huge unemployment demonstrations, and, of course, the miner strikes and the garment workers and the clothing worker strikes. That's the kind of thing that changed Roosevelt, because in 1933, Norman Thomas said that this guy was proto-fascist. No, seriously. The National Industrial Recovery Act was a corporatist effort, and when the labor movement started to move, and don't forget Huey Long, and don't forget Townsend in California, and don't forget Upton Sinclair's End Poverty in California, these movements were all part of what made the Roosevelt administration say, if we're going to win in 1936, we better head these people off at the pass. But we got to have something like that, because otherwise we can't expect anything.
Barbara.
Okay. First of all, I don't think we're in a position to decide which issues are going to emerge and which issues should be pushed that will put pressure on the Obama administration. I think those issues will emerge, and we will support that process. I wish we were powerful enough to choose which issues there will be, but I don't think we are. I agree with what Stanley just said. My own sense is that the issue of foreclosures and layoffs and the cutbacks in social services are affecting millions of people across the country. The problem is they're affecting people in different sectors and in sectors that are not used to making coalitions with each other. And to the extent that we can help to make those coalitions or to form organizations that can put people in touch with each other, that those seem to me to be the kinds of issues that can have a kind of snowballing effect and that can create the sort of movement that really would put pressure on the Obama administration.
That's your friend.
Well, I think that it's going to be difficult. I can't think of how a movement could emerge that would force the issue of single-payer health care in the face of the formidable opposition to single-payer on the one hand and the difficulty of thinking of the kinds of threat power or disruptive power that such a movement could wield on the Obama administration. Now, although I agree with Barbara that it's not our place to necessarily think of all the ways in which Obama can be pressured and that different groups, different strata will pressure him in different ways, I do think that foreclosures are a ripe opportunity. It's happening on such a scale. I don't think it really matters that a lot of the people who are being foreclosed on are not in exactly the same social position, in the same town, in the same state. I think that movement to resist foreclosures would get a lot of sympathy from local government officials, for one thing, because the foreclosure rates are so high. We've already seen that it gets a lot of sympathy from local officials. In the Great Depression, mayors declared a moratorium on evictions in some of the big cities for a similar kind of reason. It was a popular strategy that made the continuation of the policy impossible, because the continuation made the city or the banking system or the nation ungovernable. So I think foreclosures are a great opportunity. I also think that we should work with the groups in the city who are contemplating occupying vacant buildings. There will be a lot of vacant buildings in this town because Mayor Bloomberg, the plutocrat, has promoted the gentrification of Manhattan and large parts of Brooklyn and Queens and even the Bronx. And he has encouraged the building of glass towers where working class neighborhoods once stood. Those working class people have been pushed out, and the condos in the glass towers are not going to sell, and they're not going to be occupied while homelessness grows. We should not allow that.
I want to ask each of you, just as a wrap-up before we turn to questions, to identify briefly one major challenge that you see facing the left and progressive social movements in terms of its relationship with the Obama administration. So who wants to start? Or should I speak for everybody?
Yeah, go ahead, Bill.
Gian.
Well, I mean,
the question was one major challenge each that the panelists see that face the left and progressive social movements in dealing with the Obama administration. You know, it could be right now or over the next few years.
So, right now we're in the context where our social movements aren't strong or threatening. As I said at the beginning, the Obama movement is really consolidating into a movement that's really controlled by Obama to support the administration and the administration's agenda. If the social movements that we're talking to then build and provide an alternative and push those, I think it's really unclear. At this time, I think the space is pretty wide open for us to build, and we have to take that. If those movements build, I think, and actually don't agree with or push the administration's agenda, whether Obama yields to that and moves his position to the left or responds to it by repressing or using his own movement, his own infrastructure to repress those movements, I think is unclear. I think the hope would be that the movements would build and that we would actually, you know, exert pressure, and that Obama would, you know, be pressured by that left pressure and respond. But I think the history of states has largely been to repress social movements, and so I think that's what we'd have to look for. I think that's sometime in the future. The other thing is that right now, in terms of what Barbara and Fran and other people have said, there's a tremendous amount of public sympathy for dramatic actions. I think the moral sympathy for, whether it be foreclosure or armed banks, they now are the enemy. And I think there's a tremendous mass support for doing things like that.
Briefly.
When those Chicago workers conducted a sit-in in the plant, the window plant, which is a dramatic action, Obama supported them. I think the big challenge for us in relationship to Obama is what we've been saying in the last couple of minutes, which is, are we ready to do direct action? I mean, that is the major problem. And specifically, where the left has still some legitimacy as well as some historical experience, which is on the question of war and peace, I don't think we ought to let any administration, one way or another, get away with that war in Afghanistan and Iraq. I really don't see it. That's where we have institutions which have been laying low because they are not prepared to take on this administration. And I think that's the big lesson. The big lesson in relationship to the Obama administration, or for that matter any administration, has got to be we've got to build our own independent power. It may take a long time, and we got to do it both in action, and we also have to build political formations that represent the alternative to the Obama administration, so the Obama administration ultimately, or any other administration, will hear the voices.
And that's all we have time for from that portion of a discussion panel at the Left Forum this past weekend, titled The Obama Campaign and Presidency, Lessons for the Left. And the voices we heard were the moderator, Bill Fletcher, Jr., Stanley Aronowitz, Gihan Pereira, Francis Fox Piven, and Barbara Epstein. Go to our website, btlonline.org, and you can find some additional audio files there. In fact, that entire audio file, we left out a lot of it on this little half-hour take. But btlonline.org is a place right on the front page where you can see some links to audio files from the Left Forum. And we'll probably link up to some other groups that have recorded other panels that we didn't get ourselves. So with that said, thank you all for listening tonight. Thank you for your support for this independent, non-commercial, listener-sponsored radio station, WPKN in Bridgeport at 89.5 FM and WPKM in Montauk at 88.7 FM. If you haven't contributed during our recent fund drive, please consider doing so. Make a secure online contribution at WPKN.org. If you find what we're doing here interesting and unique on the radio dial in these here parts, please support it. It won't continue without your support. And that's it for myself, Scott Harris. John Laser is up next. I believe JF and John will be doing the program together up till midnight. So stay tuned, and we'll leave you with a little music that I just found, something from a band called 100-Year Flood. So stay tuned. John Laser is up next. And just a reminder, our website, WPKN.org and BTLonline.org, for some places to get links and audio files from this and other shows. Stay tuned.
I can't get no Good evening. You're listening to WPKN 89.5 FM, Bridgeport, Connecticut. WPKM 88.7 FM in Montauk, New York. And on the internet at www.wpkn.org. My name is John Laser, and I will be with you here until about 2 o'clock this morning. So let's see, what do we hear? We just heard I Can't Get No Satisfaction from the Heptones. And that does lead me into an idea for this evening. I think we will try the cover version and the original of the song, since that's always a favorite. So I'll probably do some of that for this evening for a little while. Maybe within an hour or so, I do have a pair of tickets to give away to see the Marshall Tucker Band this coming Friday evening, I believe it is, at Toad's Place in New Haven for an 8 o'clock, 8:30 show. I'll let you know when I'm giving those away. I'll probably have some sort of small trivia question for you to answer if you wish. Then call with the right answer, and you get yourself a pair of tickets to go see Marshall Tucker at Toad's in New Haven this coming Friday night. So in about an hour or so, I'll do that. And let's see. So we just heard the cover version of that one. So let's hear the original.